Well, first of all, many thanks to the organizers. I think that it's a great initiative, and I'm glad that I can speak here. So for those who don't know me yet, I am part of Roger Malko's research group. We are focused on quantum many-body physics, condensed matter, and computational physics. And machine learning came in about 2 years ago, essentially as a computational method to solve problems in quantum many-body physics. It was introduced, or essentially like kicked off, by Roger and Juan Grosquilla, who was a postdoc at PI at that time. And since then, this field has evolved quite a bit, and it basically became a research field in its own right, like the combination between machine learning and quantum many-body physics. And so today, because the field is so new, I cannot expect any background knowledge. I decided to give you kind of a crash course introduction to machine learning and how it is used in physics, and why we should be excited about it. So the good thing is, you all know physics. We can skip that and start with machine learning. Machine learning is basically part of your everyday life, even if you're not aware of it. There are several parts, several fields within machine learning. And I just have like the three main bricks in here. Computer vision, for example, it's probably most famous for self-driving cars. And the underlying task that the computer has to solve there is object recognition. So the same technology is used in the photos, in the photo library on your phone, for example, where your photos are sorted by the people and the places, and you can even search for keywords. I don't know whether you ever tried or not, but it's pretty cool. At least when you're using Google Photos, you can search for dog, and it will provide you the list of all your photos with the dog on it, even though you never tagged any of your photos with dog. And then there is recommender systems, something that you all know and encounter on a daily basis. There is Amazon, there is Netflix, which suggests you which movie to watch next based on your previous ratings. And there is also Spotify or Apple Music, which puts together a playlist especially for you based on your music preferences. Another huge part of machine learning is natural language processing. There is, for example, Gmail. I guess we all use it. And based on the content of the incoming message, it provides you three short answer suggestions. And typically, these are fairly good. Then there are the captions on YouTube, which are being created automatically to the videos based on the language which is actually spoken in the video. Machine translation is also part of it. Maybe you know the WordLens. This is this app which automatically translates signs into your preferred language. And then, of course, this technology is also used to power different assistants, most famously Siri. She's there. That's cool. So it seems like machine learning is used mostly for online tools, but this is not the case. It is also used in many industries for a variety of tasks. I just didn't have pretty pictures here, but essentially, whenever you have a large amount of data, machine learning is useful. For factories, process optimization based on sensor data. Banks do fraud detection based on transaction data. Pharma industry does drug discovery based on protein data banks. And in healthcare, diagnostic medical imaging is a big thing, which is also done by machine learning. So I guess given all that, it's natural and understandable that machine learning is viewed as the driving force behind the fourth industrial revolution, because it powers and it is the underlying software behind many technological breakthroughs, like robotics, artificial intelligence, self-driving vehicles. And the transformative power of machine learning is considered similar to the invention of the steam engine, electricity, personal computers, and the internet. Now, there is sometimes a little bit of confusion about artificial intelligence and machine learning, And I would like to put this into context, because sometimes these two are being used interchangeably, but they're not quite the same. So artificial intelligence is the entire research field which is dedicated to the long-standing goal of implementing human-type intelligence in a machine. And machine learning can be seen as a subset of artificial intelligence. In essence, it is a set of tools which allows machines to learn from data and to improve with experience. And then there is deep learning. And deep learning, in fact, can be used interchangeably with machine learning. It is a subset of machine learning, but it is the improved machine learning. Essentially, around 2012, there were some major algorithmic breakthroughs which allowed machine learning to scale up and be even more useful. So whenever machine learning is used now on a large scale in industry, it is deep learning. But I would like to point out a little bit more this difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning. And there is a very cool historic example for that. So AI was basically already making headlines in the 90s when the IBM computer named Deep Blue defeated Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion. It was the first victory of this kind when a machine was stronger than a human player. And Deep Blue, by the way, it was 1997. So Deep Blue was an amazing computer with 30 processors and 480 custom integrated circuits designed specifically to play chess. And with this compute power, it was able to calculate and evaluate 200 million moves per second, and then pick the most favorable move to do next. So with this, it was able to defeat the human champion. And at that time, or even now, Deep Blue is considered an instance of artificial intelligence. However, there are two important caveats about it. First of all, this humongous supercomputer was able to perform one task, to play chess. There was absolutely no generalization possible. And the second point is that it relied entirely on brute force. And we know actually too well that brute force has very strict limitations. For instance, if you increase the complexity of the game, instead of chess, we play Go. Here are a couple of lines which show the characteristics of the game complexity, and Go exceeds chess in all of them by at least one order of magnitude. And I want to draw your attention in particular to the bottom line. The state space complexity, which is a measure that I would say physicists can relate to. So in chess, there are 10 to the power of 47 possible legal configurations of the board. In Go, this number is 10 to the power of 170. What's the estimated number of atoms in the universe? Somebody give me a guess? 10 to the 80. Yes, I heard it from there, 10 to the 80. So let that sink in, 10 to 170. The bottom line of this is you cannot brute force Go. There is no supercomputer that would be able to do this. And so for a long time, people considered that it will be impossible that a machine would ever defeat a human expert in the game of Go. Until 2016, when AlphaGo played against Lee Sedol. AlphaGo is a machine developed by Google, Alphabet, and Lee Sedol was the Go world champion at that time, or is still the human Go world champion. And as if that was not enough, next year they updated their machine. There was AlphaGo Zero. And AlphaGo Zero just crashed AlphaGo in 100 games, 100 to zero. So I'll explain the difference between AlphaGo and AlphaGo Zero later. But the point here is that in these 20 years, a very important step was made from brute force to machine learning, because both AlphaGo and AlphaGo Zero rely on machine learning. And of course, AlphaGo is very involved. But just to give you an impression, right now, using machine learning technology, or rather techniques, you can create a chess-playing machine which will defeat IBM's Deep Blue and any human champion just on your laptop. So this compute power that you have on your laptop will be sufficient to create a chess-playing machine right now that will be superior to this 30 processor supercomputer from IBM. And this is how much things have changed. So the interesting question now is, it's all computers, right? Deep Blue was a computer, AlphaGo is a computer. So what is it about machine learning that people do differently? Like, we still write code when we do machine learning. And this is best explained on this simple task. I would ask you to write a computer program that will distinguish between images of apples and oranges. That is, I give you an image of a piece of fruit, and your program is supposed to tell me it's an apple or it's an orange. So how do you go about that? You'll start collecting differences. What are the distinctive features? Well, maybe it's the color, the shape, the bumpy surface of an orange and the smooth surface of an apple, and maybe the apple has a green leaf and oranges typically don't. So you write lines and lines of code. And then once you're done and you've written down all the rules, I'll give you two more examples. And then suddenly there is a green apple and there is an orange with a green leaf, and damn, it breaks at least some of your rules in the program. And you have to go back and to extend your code to account for these exceptions. And the problem is, no matter how many lines of code you'll write, you cannot account for this variability. And so this task, even though it seems simple, is impossible to solve without machine learning. Because what we need here is not a machine that follows rules, but rather a machine that derives rules based on the data and the task that we provided. And this is exactly what is accomplished by machine learning. So let's look in a little bit more technical details. Machine learning can be roughly subdivided into supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement learning. Supervised learning is the most straightforward approach. We are given data with labels, and what we want is a classification or a regression. Classification is something like we did right now with apples and oranges. Regression would be something similar, but say we provided houses and described the features of the house and want the machine to predict the price based on this, right? The market price of the house. Now, unsupervised learning is a little bit less well-defined in the sense that we are given data, but we do not have labels. And this is the more typical case in reality. So what we want in this case is to find some kind of pattern in this data. That means we're looking for clustering associations and maybe for the underlying probability distribution for this sample. And typical applications of unsupervised learning are market segmentation, genetic analysis, and recommender systems. Reinforcement learning is quite different than the other two. And this is something that reminds me most of biological experiments, I would say. I'd compare it to conditioning. So we do not have any explicit data in this case. What we have is an agent in the sense that, well, we define a network, a neural network, in some environment. And we provide it with a set of rules. And then we let it act in this environment. And we want it to act in the way such that it maximizes some notion of reward. It sounds complicated, but basically it's like creating a bot which plays Tetris, right? You have some notion of reward, this is the score that you get, and you have a set of rules which define, well, you can turn your, the stone in this direction, that direction, you can move it to the left, to the right, and this is the set of rules that is fixed, but then the behavior is not. And so the agent starts exploring and modifies its behavior based on the reward that it gets. And this is how AlphaGo was trained, mainly. And actually, this is a very interesting difference between AlphaGo and AlphaGo Zero. So AlphaGo was trained first in a supervised framework on recorded data from human games. games of Go. 30 million, I think. So it was trained to basically repeat the strategies that human players were taking. And then it was improved a little bit by playing against it. So just to test how is it doing? How well did it learn? So that machine was sufficient to defeat Lee Sedol. But AlphaGo Zero, the next version, was trained entirely by reinforcement learning. They took out the supervised learning part. They only defined the set of rules, basically the set of rules in Go, where can you place your stones? And then they let the machine play against itself for very many times. And so I think it's a very interesting and thought-provoking result that the machine, which was trained with zero human knowledge, data, was superior than the one which has seen human experience, in this sense. Okay, so now we'll focus on supervised learning and look into some technical details. We want to train a classifier on a data set which consists of handwritten digits from 0 to 9. They are all labeled by the appropriate digit in the sense of which digit is this image representing or supposed to represent. We have 70,000 images like that, and they are all 28 by 28 pixels on grayscale. This is the so-called MNIST dataset, and MNIST stands for Modified National Institute for Standards and Technology. So what we're looking for is a function or an approximation for the function which will map from the space of images to the space of labels. And the space of labels, or the space of images, is 28 by 28, which is 784. And the space of labels is 10-dimensional because we have 10 different digits. And as an ansatz for this function, we use an artificial neural network. These can be shaped differently. They can have different size. But the one presented here is a deep, fully connected feed-forward network. It is deep because it has several layers stacked onto each other. It is fully connected because there are connections between each neuron in the previous layer, which leads to each neuron in the next layer. And it is a feed-forward network because the information is being fed in at the input and is propagating from there to the output in this direction and is not flowing backwards. So if we zoom in to take a look at a single neuron, well, the neurons of the network, they are computational units. Looks somewhat like that. So we're considering one unit here, unit number I. It has parameters W and B attached to it. These parameters are free. We are initializing them in some way, but we want to adjust them in the learning and the training procedure. The weights are being attached to the inputs that are coming into this unit, and the bias is then added on top. So this unit performs this computation here. It multiplies W with the incoming information X, adds the bias on top, and this sum is then passed into the activation function that is defined for this unit. And the activation function is typically nonlinear. A common choice is a sigmoid, but also like a step function, NH, or the rectified linear unit are being used. So we collect the information, sum it up, process it through this activation function, and then this is what we pass on to the next layer, to the units in the next layer. And once we get to the output layer, we collect a prediction, YI, a prediction for the label. And since we are given, we are in a supervised framework, we are given data, we are comparing this to the true label. And our ultimate goal is to train the network in a way that the prediction is correct. So we need to define some sort of discrepancy measure between the true label and the predicted label. So what we do, we define a cost function. Here, the cost function can have various forms depending on your model. Here it is a very simple quadratic cost where we just take the difference between the prediction and the true label and sum it over all inputs. And this cost function defines a landscape. On this landscape, we are looking for a minimum because we want to minimize the function, the cost function. because we want to minimize the discrepancy between the network prediction and the true label. And the way we do it is typically by using gradient descent. That means we update parameters based on this rule. The new parameters are going to be the old parameters minus the learning rate times the gradient of the cost function. Learning rate is one of the hyperparameters that we'll have to tune in order for the network to learn successfully. Okay, so the training procedure consists in taking a loop over the data set that we are given and adjusting the weights and biases such that we minimize the cost function. MNIST is typically split into 60,000 training images and 10,000 testing images. And then what we need to do in order for the, it is absolutely not straightforward that the network would train successfully. So we need to adjust the hyperparameters. It is the mini batch size, which means how many examples do we take for one update of the weights into account for the gradient descent. The learning rate, which you have seen, which is the multiplicative factor in the gradient descent equation. The number of epochs, which is how many times do we loop over the training set while the training procedure, and also the number of hidden units, that is essentially the size of the network. How many computational units do we have there, and also how many layers. But now, assuming that we have chosen all that in a way that the network learns, we will evaluate it once it is trained. We will evaluate its performance on the test set. That means we let it classify the images that it has not seen before and record the prediction accuracy. So a one-layer feedforward network, a very simple one with 100 units that you train on your computer in about 10 minutes, will give you a prediction accuracy of 98%. That is, the classification error will be 2%, which is already pretty good. And then a state-of-the-art network, it is more complex, will give you an accuracy, or rather the error rate, of 0.21. And this is essentially as high as you can get, just because there are some really ugly examples in MNIST, like these, where you really can't tell which digit this is supposed to represent. So you cannot achieve 0% error on this test, on this data set. Sorry. Yeah.
Do you have to initialize the W and B parameters?
Yeah, typically.
Is the outcome sensitive to that initial?
Yeah. Yeah. Depends on the case, depends on the network. But yeah, the initialization can have a huge effect. This is essentially also one of the hyperparameters, so to say, like something that you have to tune. Okay, so now that we're all impressed by how machine learning, you know, how cool it is and what tasks it can solve, we might wonder how to make it useful for physics, right? And in physics, at least people in condensed matter and many body physics, we like to explain the world with spin systems. And the thing that we like most about spin systems is phases, phase transitions. So why don't we take a 2D Ising model and generate configurations of the 2D Ising model with Monte Carlo sampling, and then label them as ferromagnetic and paramagnetic, because there are two obvious phases, and then let the network classify whether what it sees, the spin configuration, is a paramagnet or a ferromagnet. The cool thing about it is we take essentially the same network that we were using for to classify the digits and just use it and train it on this other data set. And I don't know whether it is what you expect or not, but the result is pretty good. The network can classify the configurations of the 2D Ising model easily. On the left, you see a plot where the prediction of the last layer is plotted versus the temperature. And you see that one neuron activates mainly for the low temperature phase, the other neuron activates mainly for the high temperature phase. The intersection of these two lines gives us an estimate of the critical temperature. And what is cooler, it shows a finite size, a correct finite size scaling. So if we do a data collapse here, as you can see in this plot, we'll get correct estimates for the critical exponent and also extract the critical temperature from this. And now, remember this supercomputer from IBM, which is basically artificial intelligence, but it can only play chess. Now, this is a very important difference, that we're using the same neural network, we're using a very similar training procedure. And so we can even achieve transfer learning with this. That means we train the model on a square lattice Ising model, and then on the configurations of square lattice Ising model, and then we lattice classify configurations from a triangular lattice. And it does succeed, because essentially the models are in the same universality class, and the network, once trained on the square lattice, has no difficulties to make good predictions for the triangular lattice. You can read about it more in this publication that I've linked here with the archive number. It's actually a Nature publication. It is this paper that I mentioned previously by Juan and Roger. But this is not the only application. This was just the very beginning. What people do is, or have done in the past couple of years, was different kinds of phase classifications, topological phases, quantum and classical, supervised learning, unsupervised learning, detection of phase contours, efficient representation of quantum states, which is in some way related to tensor networks. People do also explore the connections between tensor networks and machine learning, and there seems to be a lot that these algorithms have in common mathematically. One of the directions, which is pretty strong and pretty promising also, is machine learning and Monte Carlo sampling. So machine learning assisted Monte Carlo sampling, or the self-learning Monte Carlo, you'll probably hear about that. That's working pretty well. There are applications of machine learning in quantum physics in the sense of quantum experiments. For example, the quantum state reconstruction or tomography, that is one project that we were doing this summer with our summer students, actually. So you are using unsupervised learning, in particular restricted Boltzmann machines, for those who know that, you can reconstruct the quantum state from some observations, from measurements of the state. You can learn the underlying probability distribution. And then probability distribution is essentially like the wave function, right? So you can map it back in this way. There are quantum algorithms for machine learning assisted quantum error correction, and the so-called neural decoders. And people also show that we can learn quantum models from both quantum and classical data. And the list goes on and on. And if you're curious and interested, I would advise you to take a look at this website. Just Google us. It's Physics ML or Physics Machine Learning. We maintain a list of relevant publications in this field on the intersection between quantum many-body physics and machine learning. And you can see, just scroll through the titles, you can see a lot of directions that people are working on and exploring. And it provides you at least some sort of overview. There are essentially no limitations in this way, because people just started exploring it. And it's a very interesting moment to be involved in it, because basically there are very few options that have been discovered by now, right? And there are many more that you still can discover. It's just about your specific approach and basically your creativity, right? So there's one more comment that I would like to make before finishing this talk, which concerns very common criticism about machine learning. And it is true. The problem about machine learning, specifically deep learning, is that it is a black box. Now, this is a trade-off. It is an extremely powerful method, but you have to take into account it was developed mainly by practitioners, and it was developed in a very short time. And that means for people who do not care about why. For example, recommender systems and image recognition or image classifications were two very important developments that made machine learning and allowed for deep learning to develop. And in these cases, you can judge by the output whether it is reasonable what the machine is doing or not. So you are not concerned about the reasons why the machine makes a certain prediction. But this lack of interpretability and the lack of control is very limiting for the application of machine learning in certain areas. For example, in finance, in healthcare, but also in physics. Because if we do not have a reference, if we are trying to calculate something where we do not have access to by conventional methods, then we do not have a reasonable check for it. And this is something that, well, opposes and limits the application of machine learning in our field. The good news is, though, that I think that from the perspective of physics, like with our background, we can help to develop a theory of deep learning. And this is actually my main research focus, or at least the one that I'm most excited about, to try and break down deep learning as a process and to analyze it, to be able to understand it better. And this might help us to have better control, and in this way, to find new methods, which again, in turn, will be useful for physics. So it's a great potential that I see in there, and this is why I'm super excited about it, and I'm really happy about more physicists getting involved in it. Right. Now, I hope we have some time for questions, and if not, then just let's chat in the break. Thank you. We do have time for questions, right?
We have sufficient time for questions.
Like this?
We have about 10 minutes.
This is actually real. Oh, okay. Yeah, there is a reflection on this clock, which makes it look like it's printed, you know, like as if it was just paper. Honestly, like from this point of view, I thought it was like, oh, it's just fake. Okay. Right, cool. Questions? Any type of question.
No one has a question, I'll start with one.
Can we start with, okay.
Neural networks faster than just calculating RG fixed points?
Say again?
Is the neural network that you use to classify phases faster than calculating RG fixed points, or more accurate or something?
No. That work that I've shown, it was basically for benchmarking. In the sense that you still need data, right, to train it. It was supervised learning. So you still need Monte Carlo configurations. So in this sense, of course, you can criticize if you do Monte Carlo, then you already have the data from which you can compute the fixed points or the critical exponents by the conventional numerical methods. So in this sense, there is no major advantage. It was more about exploring how far can we go with machine learning.
Different choices of error function or cost function affects the landscape we're going through and the efficiency of gradient descent optimizing.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. What was the question? I thought it was a statement.
Does that happen?
That does, yes. Yeah. Well,
is there a conventional choice of cost function?
There are some standard, yeah. There are some typical cost functions that are being used. You'll often see the cross entropy cost. You decide about the cost function based on your model and on the specifics, like what are you training? Are you training a classifier? How many outputs do you have? And so on. It is definitely something that defines the optimization landscape, but I think it is not the major factor there. There's actually a lot of research going on about the optimization landscape. People are looking at it and trying to, you know, this is one of the approaches of people who try to understand stochastic gradient descent and this optimization procedure. So there are actually other, I would say, more important factors which influence the loss landscape. And they're all related to these hyperparameters that you choose for when training your model, something like the batch size, mini batch size, and the learning rate. And also, well, there are like more technicalities. But yeah, I think the shape of the cost function, or the choice of the cost function, is not as important, because in any case, it is a very non-convex problem. And this is something that, yeah, you know, causes this very, very complicated loss landscape. Florian?
So in practical problems, like a lot of time you would spend in fiddling with the hyperparameters, right?
Yes.
Do any people use machine learning to do that fiddling?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So you can do grid search, of course, just like massive computation which tries out different parameters. And then there are some conventional wisdoms which, you know, recommend you to use this or that when you're doing this and that. And there's like a, you know, portion of magic in there. It's like the art in the state of the art. So you have to try around, and it can have a major influence. Yeah. But there are approaches that, as you say, use machine learning to learn the hyperparameters. I don't know about the details though.
Can you say more about the theory of deep learning that you're working on?
Theory of deep learning?
Yeah, like you didn't say much, you just left it there. So.
Yeah, so the theory of deep learning, I could spend a long time talking about that. So the way I'm, like, there is essentially no theory of deep learning right now. People just started working on it. There is some conventional, some old school learning theory. If you look up, you'll find the names Vapnik and Chermanenkis and people who were in like hardcore maths and statistics. Essentially, it's like machine learning is the modern, you know, revamped version of statistical learning. It was learned by, was something that mathematicians learn typically. So statistical learning became machine learning, and then they made the step to deep learning. So this is where the connection broke, because you cannot make any rigorous statements about deep learning. You cannot follow, you know, this track, because if you have multiple layers and each layer has a ton of units and each unit is a nonlinear function of the input of the previous layer, this is something you cannot analyze with hardcore mathematics. So the interesting point here is that you can analyze this from statistical physics. Like if you have a background in statistical physics, and people do compare the processes, for example, this optimization process and stochastic gradient descent, they try to approach it from the point of view of statistical physics and to compare it to non-equilibrium processes, for example. And this seems like a promising direction. And there's also a little bit of information theory that goes into that. And this is basically like the two directions that I'm trying to approach it from, like statistical physics and information theory, because I think that this is something that is really promising. There are also approaches from the side mathematicians, but typically they end up simplifying the model very much. But this is like the common trade-off. Nobody's to blame for it, right? Because you simplify the model, then you can make some more or less rigorous statements. But then the simplified model is so far away from the real world model that you do not really know whether the conclusions that you have drawn on a simplified model actually apply to the real world model.
So what sort of an answer are you looking for? Like,
what sort of answer?
Yeah.
The goal would be to have better, like, first of all, to have a better control about this procedure. So there are deep questions and there are more superficial questions. For example, what is the effect of the number of layers in the network? And what is the effect of the mini batch size and the learning rate? And how, like, what's the interplay? There is one more or less recent paper, for example, which considers the stochastic gradient descent, the update rule that we use in machine learning, as a discretized version of a continuous stochastic differential equation. And from this approach, you can basically show that it is not the learning rate or just the mini batch size, but actually the ratio, or like the square root of the ratio of these two parameters, that are a control parameter in your model. So there are small statements like that that all have to be, you know, like people are looking to unify them, and whatever is derived in theory are being checked in practice. And this is just the very beginning. So it is hard to predict how far we can get, whether there is a rigorous theory of deep learning in the sense that, you know, we would derive everything from scratch. Not sure about that. But there are definitely approaches that will help us to understand at least parts of it, at least something, say, regarding the optimization procedure or something regarding the loss landscape. And maybe at some point we'll get there, you know, like to the point where we unify these different views and get consistent theory about it.
So, have they applied any of these, well, techniques that they used to study classical phases of statistical systems to, say, confinement in QCD, like lattice gauge theory?
To apply lattice gauge theory to?
Like, to get, or has anyone tried to get some machine learning algorithm to recognize confinement, for example, like in gauge theories?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. Matt, you know what people have tried or not? I got the impression that, yes, there was something like that. There are like several very, very creative works in the, on this side where people are looking into parallels between RG, for example, the renormalization group in deep learning. That was kind of a thing. There were like at least three publications on that arguing that deep learning is the same as RG. And then other publications arguing that that's not the case. There are some papers that I noticed about holographic dualities. What was that? Matt, can you help me with that? Like,
so some neural networks are dual to some tensor networks, which are dual to some holographic space times. That's what people say.
Yeah, that was that. And another interesting direction, also like a parallel with physics, was where people considered glass systems, spin glass systems, and compared that to neural networks. But I think there the result was more or less conclusive that they're not the same, but at least they analyzed. Yeah.
Okay. Let's thank Anna once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.